You're listening to Vatican Radio. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization is holding its 40th plenary conference in Rome this week, focusing on issues around climate change, agriculture and food security. In a message sent to the July 3rd to 8th meeting, Pope Francis highlighted the right of every individual to be free from poverty and hunger. He said there's an urgent need for solidarity to be the criterion inspiring all forms of cooperation in international relations. Among those attending the conference was Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, who also serves as Minister for Agriculture and Water Resources. He told me more about the message he was bringing from his country to this important international gathering.
One of pragmatism, one of understanding the mathematics of the equation that we have to solve, that in the next 50 years, the world will consume as much food as it has in human history to this point. So that's an awesome requirement, an awesome equation. And what that also means is that we have to understand that if you are too philosophically pure, the result of that will be that other people in other parts of the world will starve to death. What I mean by that is you might go on with religious zeal pursuing a certain outcome for social requirements or whatever, the result of which is you don't produce as much food as is required. The outcome of which is that some person that you've never met before has no food and they starve to death. It's quite simple. If I take rice out of production or don't produce enough rice, it's not the people in Europe or America or Australia starve. It's the pool of rice globally is insufficient to feed the requirements, and someone in North Africa starves to death, or millions of people starve to death. And that's absolutely possible if you get it wrong. It can be exacerbated by turmoil, whether it's turmoil between countries or other issues. Climatic issues come into play, but I always see this as an issue that runs in parallel, but it's not the same issue. I get worried when people talk only about climate change and you say, well, that's very interesting and very important, but it doesn't answer the question of how I'm going to produce food right now. That's an important question that needs to be answered right now.
It's a very important question, particularly because the Director General of the FAO was saying today that hunger is on the rise now again.
That's
isn't
correct.
It reversing the progress that we've
yeah.
made?
It's
very difficult to see how we will be able to meet these 2030 Sustainable Development Goals.
Well, the caloric requirements and people being deficient, that is becoming more prevalent. We're seeing that, and there is a rise in people who are hungry. And you know, these are the ones that we have a noble cause to go out there and provide food for. And there are ways that, see, in the past we've had the Green Revolution, we've had always had the capacity to take a quantum leap by the delivery of fertiliser, the construction of new fertilisers, the creation of, for instance, dwarf wheat, which gave an exponential outcome in yield for wheat. Now we have the capacity to do it again with genetic modification, but some people say, oh, no, I don't want genetic modification, we can't talk about that. They say, oh, okay, that's fine. That means the people who grow wheat like ourselves will get paid a lot more. We will. We'll be rich. You're helping me out. You're making me become wealthy. But there's a payment for this, and that person over there in Somalia or Ethiopia or Kenya or one of the Pacific Islands, they starve, but you're all right with that, aren't you?
Pope Francis, in fact, sent a message to this FAO meeting saying that solidarity, precisely what you're talking about, solidarity must be the criterion inspiring all forms of cooperation in international relations. How do you square that with your national interests?
Well, I'm of the view that if we do this well, we're going to be looking for farmers. I've always said to people, you know, if you believe that parochialism is the one that wins, then farmers 150 years ago would be vastly wealthier than ones today and better stand alone, because they're not. The reality is farmers are the first people to starve. That's generally what happens. So we are in a vastly better position than we were 150 years ago by reason of trade, by reason of pragmatism. Let's make sure that if we stay on that path, there's going to be enough produce that needs to be produced, there's going to be enough money to be made, that they'll get a better return back through the farm gate. Farmers will make more money, but we've got to understand that this equation means all shoulders to the wheel. We can't just rely on the winds of the Green Revolution of the 1940s to 1960 bracket to be still carrying us over and winning for us now. And if you want to be more prudent in how you use water, well, that's also about how you make sure you've got the right plant species. And if you want to make sure that you can turn lesser lands into protein, well, there's a conversion unit that turns less lands into protein. That's called animals. It's called sheep. It's called cattle. It's called goats. You might be able to grow mung beans or chickpeas on the side of a hill, but you can graze animals on the side of the hill, which means from marginal land you have the capacity to get a food unit. if people say, oh, well, we're just going to have, and they're not, but if they said, well, we're going to have a global vegetarian diet, there'd be mass starvation because there's only certain areas which grow the certain crops that can deliver a vegetable protein. So we, that's why you can't have this religious zealotry. You have to have a pragmatic approach, and people have to acknowledge that on a global scale. If we want to answer this mathematical riddle of how we produce enough food in the next 50 years as humanity has produced in its existence to this day.
You're talking about climate change being only part of the equation, but it's surely an important part of the equation today. How concerned are you? I mean, Australia is the world's driest continent, and I understand that drought is increasing.
Droughts are always with us, and look, it's an issue. And we sign up to international agreements such as Paris. We're doing our bit. We're ahead of the curve of where we need to be. We're doing what we have to do. And so I don't say it in a dismissive way, like ignore it. What I'm saying is that don't make that your only discussion piece. And I always get a bit concerned if you go to conferences and they just turn a conference where you're trying to work out how to feed people into a conference about global warming. What's our target? Our target's to produce food. Why? Because of the noble outcome of trying to make sure people don't starve. How are we going to do it? Let's have those pragmatic, realistic, scientific approaches to how we're going to splice a new photosynthesis gene into wheat so we get a better utilization of light in wheat so you can get a better production outcome. Maybe whilst we're doing it, we can have nitrate fixating genes in there so you can actually fertilize your field as you grow from it. These things are all possible. And if we go back in the past, we would see that what the scientists did was, create dwarf wheats, they create rust-resistance wheats. And what was the outcome of all that? We take Mexico. Between 1946 and 1963, Mexico increased their production of wheat by sixfold. Okay, people say, brilliant. But that was to deal with an equation then. Now we're going to deal with an equation now.
Looking at this question about, you say that Australia signed up to the Paris Agreement, you're absolutely doing your bit.
Yep.
There's a lot of debate, I understand, though, over renewables versus the continued pursuit of fossil fuels,
sure.
Particularly regarding this Indian firm Adani at Abbott Point on the Queensland coast.
Okay. Well, let's break this issue down. First of all, I represent in the National Party the poorest seats. I represent farming areas. And I'm quite adamant that I'm not going to deliver back to my people unaffordable power, because that all I'm doing there is making people poorer. That's not what we're going to do. We're going to have affordable power. It's going to be reliable. Otherwise, we are literally making people poorer, and there is nothing more galling than someone who has the affluence to be able to support a lifestyle where the power bill is rather exceptional, because they can pay for it out of their doctor's salary or out of their solicitor's salary or out of the salary from an inner suburban high-paying job. And then the person in a shed out in the country or a run-down weatherboard nine house, they say, well, I can't afford power. And so what happens in winter? I get really, really cold, and summer I get really, really hot. And apparently you believe that's a moral good. Well, I reckon it's, I reckon it's economic bastardry.
I mean, there is a lot of debate about the damage that this might do to the Great Barrier Reef,
for example,
and I'm wondering...
Even that, see, these are these sort of hyperventilating arguments which are not correct. First of all, what Adani is actually about the Galilee Basin, the opening up of a new coal field. I mean, India has got 300 million people who don't have power. They cook with animal manure. And I don't see anybody around here wanting to cook with animal manure. I don't see them walking out picking up, feces off the street to cook dinner on. Why should they? Why should they have to do it? When did someone say, well, you are somehow a superior person that can inflict that on somebody else? Now, you've got to bring people with you. So Adani's not interested in coal power. They're interested in power, full stop. Cheap power. And if they don't buy coal from the Galilee Basin, they will just dig up coal. We only produce less than 4% of the world's coal. So if they don't dig up the coal in the Galilee Basin, they'll just dig it up in India. And they'll knock over forests to do it, and they'll knock over towns to do it. And the coal they'll dig up will be vastly more carbon inefficient than our coal. So they'll still build their power stations. They'll just do it with highly inefficient coal, where we have a more efficient coal, and we can do it in a more environmentally sustainable way. We're not going to be knocking over towns and knocking over forests to build the mine, the Galilee Basin. And I believe that what we should be focusing on is building the most efficient power stations, whether they're coal, whether they're nuclear, whether they're solar, whether they're wind. And that's generally what's been happening. And I think that if we get into this religious, once more another religious corner, say we don't believe in coal-fired power anymore, there's another side to that equation. If you believe in only renewables, it's highly intermittent, and we've seen it by real life experience, it becomes highly expensive and unreliable. You've got to walk on both feet. You can't hop in this one. So you're going to have renewables, but you're also going to have baseload power. If you don't want coal, well, that's fine. You've got to believe in nuclear then. You've got to believe in other ways to do it. If you don't want nuclear, say, okay, we've got to build yourself some big dams and have hydro, because you're going to have to provide that baseload power. You say, oh, well, you know, I don't believe in any of that. You say, well, then you believe in high electricity prices, no manufacturing industry, unemployment, and poor people going without power. Since when did that become sort of the moral apex?
Going on to another question that the Pope brings
up. Can I just also say, Great Barrier Reef is about 200 to 300 kilometres away from the mine. So that is like saying, I'm really worried about what's going to happen north of Milan because of what I'm doing in Rome. It's absurd.
Moving on to another question that the Pope brings up in this message to the FAO meeting. He talks about the problems of forced displacement due to war and poverty mm-hmm. and climate change. Now, Australia has, I know, increased its share, hasn't it, of what you call genuine refugees. Yeah. But it's also been criticised for its treatment of asylum seekers, particularly on those offshore detention centres.
Yeah, sure.
Did you discuss this, can I ask you, at your meetings you've had with top Vatican officials here? Were you talking about the issues of refugees and asylum seekers?
Yeah, also talked about what we're doing. Australia remains in either the first, the second, or the third most generous country on earth per capita in the acceptance of refugees, and we're proud of that. In my own electorate, I'm proud of the work we've done with people from the Central African Republic and Rwanda, actually taking them into country areas and settling them down. I've actually made Armidale, one of the cities in my electorate, one of the premier places for the settlement of refugees. We're happy to do our bit. But we have to do it on the terms that are politically saleable. And you can't do it if people are just making their own arrangements and arriving in the country. Now, Europe's got that problem at the moment. Because what happens if you do that? If people just say, my borders are out of control, then their political pendulum swings to the extremities and you'll start getting the emergence of strong left-wing or strong right-wing groups, which are a reaction to a loss of border control. Now, you don't want that. Well, I don't want that. I want to make sure that we represent the centre of the bell curve, and we do that by saying, no, we're going to have strong borders and a very generous refugee intake, and show to the people we will still be generous, but we're going to do it through a proper process.
And yet there is still an issue of those arriving and the way they're being treated, particularly hear of the children in detention centres, for example.
If we change it round to where it was, then people just start turning up on boats. And we had 50,000 people just turned up on boats. That was before they started turning up in Europe, by the way. So we were dealing with this issue first. And everybody in Europe said how evil and bad we were. Now they're trying to replicate our policies because they can see the political swing is going to the extremities. And nobody wants that. So we acknowledge it. We had to have a strong policy and we had to have a generous refugee intake. But we were not going to have our policy determined by people who were basically smuggling people into our nation and getting paid $10,000 a hit for it, and not caring whether they lived or died. We're not sure how many people drowned. Could have been in the thousands who drowned, because people who are criminals, they don't care whether you live or die. They just chuck you in anything they think floats and push you off in the direction of Australia. And so the other side of this equation is, if you believe that people can just turn up on boats, then you must also believe that a lot of them will die. You must accept it. You say, well, I accept the fact that a lot of women and children and men and vulnerable people are going to drown, and I'm happy with that. Well, we're not happy with that. And the only way you're going to stop that is to make sure you say, well, you're just not going to get in if you come by boat, right? You have to come by the proper process. And your rights are no better than anybody else by reason that you have $10,000 and they don't. If you're a bona fide refugee, then it shouldn't be determined by the fact that you're a bona fide refugee with $10,000 as opposed to a bona fide refugee with no money. Because, otherwise, let's put in a tender system and those with the most money can come in first.
Were you able to discuss these issues with the Vatican officials that you've seen, Cardinal Parolin, Cardinal Turkson?
Yes, I did. And I also brought up other issues that I think are important. We talk about the dignity of human life. Obviously, people know I'm a pro-lifer, and we just want to make sure that we talk about those issues as well. Sometimes I think people duck that issue. I think it's a little bit hard these days. Let's talk about other things. Well, let's talk about all the issues.
You are a Catholic, aren't you? A practicing Catholic,
I understand. Yeah, I'm a practicing Catholic. I'm not a good one, but I'm a practicing Catholic. You have to practice till you get perfect, and I've got a long way to go.
How difficult do you find it sometimes to square your faith, if you like, the principles of your faith, with the difficult decisions that you have to make on a daily basis in politics?
I don't know. I'll leave that up to the good Lord. He'll make his judgment about me, and I'll just do the best job I can, eh?
My thanks to Australia's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Agriculture and Water Resources, Barnaby Joyce.